Chapter 11, Men and Love. I remember the first young man who paid attention to me, who I felt seen by, recognized by, noticed at least, if not loved. Once I responded, he came forward even more with his words, his touch, his gifts. I was just 3 weeks into my teens, and he was 15. We met in Canada, a chalet my grandfather had come to with my grandmother for many years before my birth. The setting of 10-foot snowdrifts, horse-drawn carriages with bear rugs to cover us, enormous fireplaces at the center of an old wood stone lodge, made for the most romantic setting I could imagine. And who wanted to be alone on New Year's Eve? My sister led the way, dancing with Peter McCain, and then there was Warren, Peter's friend, old enough to be with the true teens, yet for some reason choosing to spend time with me. Maybe I seemed more available, an easier catch perhaps, being so young. It really didn't matter to me or to him. We had chemistry, some might say, and the spark had been ignited. When the big tower clock hit midnight, a first kiss met all of my expectations. Channels of emotion were opened along with the first sexual feelings possible with another, a touch somehow beyond any I could ever give myself on exploration. I had met man, it seemed, the other, for the first time. The weeks that followed were filled with flowers delivered, 4-page letters revealing the feelings awakened in Warren. Such a gift he offered me, far greater than that silver ID bracelet and an invitation to, quote, go steady. His relentless pursuit, his untethered expression, his choosing to love was a permission I had been waiting for and seeking. Wandering as I had been all through childhood, where to place such feelings? I remember writing happy anniversary letters to my parents, projecting through poems the romantic love I had seen in movies onto them and every couple I met, making surprise parties for friends, treasure hunts in the woods, gifting in search of love, connection, communion. Whether with my horse, a wild animal, a neighbor, or a school playmate, I was forever exploring a gateway to intimacy. And here in Canada, on New Year's, with a young man named Warren, who lived 2,000 miles away, I had met my match. He seemed bent on loving me, outgifting me, opening his heart in a way I had suspected was possible with me, even though we were strangers in most every regard. After Christmas vacation ended, 2 letters at least came each week. They were a confirmation that something real had happened, that loving freely was possible. A force existed, including perhaps, but not dependent on hormones. 13 letters and a box with his bracelet within 3 weeks did not go unnoticed by my parents. I can remember asking for money to buy stamps in order to respond. Remember now, I was 12. But that was not to be. After a short meeting at the breakfast table, I was informed there would be no more correspondence. This was not okay, not appropriate. I was way too young. That was the kindest communication, along with other phrases coming close to suggest that the whole encounter was even sinful. Though I never saw Warren again, the seed of what was possible was watered from that time forward. In hindsight, I am grateful for my early encounters with men as lover, beloved, other. In hindsight, I can now say what a good therapist might have said then. I fell in love with every aspect of myself I was wanting to touch, to know, and to awaken. There was the cowboy Johnny White I met when vacationing on a dude ranch in Wyoming. Now, 14, I was a bit closer to what an 18-year-old might find of interest. Johnny White. He seemed content to show me barrel racing and sit alongside the Snake River at sunset. Without as much as a kiss, we corresponded for a year. Growing up watching Westerns on TV, I still could not believe we were living in Connecticut. I remember asking my parents, "Do those places on TV truly exist? The washes, the canyons, those night skies?" Hearing they did, I knew I would be there one day. And for now, Wyoming was the best taste treat. Annie Oakley was perhaps the only heroine I had noticed in film and literature, and Johnny White was the best gateway to meet the cowgirl inside. The close encounters with men were much about the woman I wanted to be, the woman I was becoming, and that continued through my teens. The dark-skinned Caribbean lifeguard on a Nassau beach. Though he could barely write English and his script was that of a child, his letters confirmed a friendship and shared love of each other and the ocean. Any parent could say we were too young to know, to experience, to feel in such ways. Yet with each one, I can say there was a simple, authentic exchange. What some olders might consider a naive expression of affection, I can't help but cherish as a trust and innocence, experienced and embedded in my heart at an early age. Whether it was the quarterback on the football team or the first one I met who knew how to skipper alone his father's sailboat, I knew I wanted to be with them, to play with them, to sail with them. They would take me where I wanted to go. That being with them, I could become more of me. In many ways, you might laugh, but such partnerships were essential in those days in order to work outside of the typing pool, to travel outside of the culture, not to mention the country. It became tricky territory to find intimacy and not marry, to make love and not have a baby, to live together and not become a wife. And it was territory I had to explore, to find ways to give, to surrender, to love fully, and not lose, but actually continue to discover myself. It seemed much easier to do that in nature, less noticed, less encumbered with projections and definitions. And yet I knew I had to find the way with humans as well, and men in particular. They were the greatest challenge of all. Through my teens into my 30s then, it's not hard to understand that I had many boyfriends, many lovers, many heart openings, heartbreaks and heartaches. I can truly say no regrets. Okay. Well, maybe one. One-night stand who seemed to have far more regrets the day after than I could handle well. They, of course, served to catalyze mine. I feel to honor each love shared by saying now, the love I felt then actually has never ended. The focus of our relationships changed after days or weeks, and in most cases after many years. I fell in love, or better yet, explored my capacity to love another, with my dance teacher, geophysicist and rock musician Stick, with a single father and man of deep devotion, John, with a mountain rescue patrolman, Dan. He could sit peacefully for hours writing poetry over a single cup of coffee. I met my match in unleashed sexual ecstasy with one who loved the goddess in every crevice of the feminine. I was blessed to have intercourse the first time in a setting we both chose, in a moment we both created, in an agreement of partnership, if not marriage, that we grew in together for 4 years. As far as I know, I was only so-called cheated on twice, ironically by the two men I had considered marrying. I had asked for honesty always and even encouraged explorations of love and intimacy transparently with others, and in one case with my best friend at the time. Their acceptance to explore was acted upon, but somehow their ability to share did not come as easily. Recognizing my inability to create such a field of love and trust was disheartening at best, even defeating. The possibility of marriage, family, and children without full trust and communication, full freedom, full love, seemed unimaginable and unattainable. Deep inside, I knew I could not be a mother and a wife in the way I had seen in my own family and others. I knew I would not become the woman I was here to be. I needed a picture other than fear of divorce when other attractions would undoubtedly arise. I needed a village, not a nanny, to help raise any child. And so I carried on, not knowing. As 40 approached, like most women, I was aware of the clock ticking, re-pregnancy, yet still no knowing came. I stopped taking birth control pills in my late 20s, recognizing numerous side effects early on. The biggest side effect, however, was one that put me into thinking I was the decider. On some level, yes, this felt right, especially after what I learned working with women in other countries where ceremonies of marriage normalized rape. Yet on another level, the choice to have a child or not seemed more than mine to make alone. To enter into the highest act of creating a life seemed to be one to make only in partnership, as it requires such a partnership with a man, or at least with his seed, as well with a family, with a community, with ancestors, with a world. Somehow, since very early on in life, the privilege of life I had been born into gave me the chance to see life itself as a privilege, to give life, something to be considered, something to be shared, something to be chosen, with more than myself and my desire driving it. Is it mine to do? Destiny is a word that expresses part of the feeling, the soul's journey to be considered along with the political, social truths and realities as well. I had been long asking what would serve me, serve others, serve this time and this world. Was it possible to consider and say yes to a child on all of those levels and somehow go beyond the family expectation, the cultural conditioning, the hormonal longing, the romantic possibility, the acclaimed ultimate love experience? Was I strong enough to say yes, dreaming a healthier way for myself and the child than I had witnessed previously? Was I clear enough of my own wounds not to simply pass them on? Was there a community to share in the care of us all, so as not to become the burdened mom, the complainer I knew lurked in my genes? Neither a yes nor a no arrived. I simply carried on, working towards the world I wanted to live in. By the time I was 40, I had partnered with men whose care for the world matched mine. I was blessed to be with visionaries of peaceful culture, leaders of citizen diplomacy, ambassadors of a new story. I was their lover, their assistant, their support, their muse, perhaps at times, their companion. And at times, my own story was lost. My wounds as a woman would surface. Yet somehow I and we made our way through to the other side, to change seats and discover new parts of ourselves. With Jim Hickman, after 4 years finding any and every opportunity to be on his team as a support in Track 2 diplomacy with the USSR, he turned his attention to supporting me in the 2-year journey to release Joe and Rosie back into the wild. Without his yes to do that, I do not think I would have found mine. And though we fell apart for many reasons as lovers, our songline continues today. He just visited here with his wife and child from Bolivia, returning to Three Creeks where they came to be with the birth of Danny 12 years ago, 33 years after our so-called romantic partnership ended. It was never clear to have a child with Jim. We were together giving birth in other ways. 1 + 1 made 3 in our projects, in our communities, at least some, if not all of the time. As the years passed, I learned what it was like, thanks to a few transparent people, to share lovers. I had touched what it could be to share in the care of the world, and now I wanted to know the possibility to share in the care of children. In the community life with Marlo, I fell in love with his wives and his children, another small taste of what was possible. And with that, with meeting a man in ceremony, I opened to the yes of being pregnant. And I became so after only one encounter with John. I experienced joy in my body, my belly, my breasts, surprise and gratitude in the father-to-be. But it was not to last long. The joy, the welcoming of the pregnancy. Although it felt destined on a certain level, especially as I had made love mostly without contraceptives for 15 years. But what I had not considered so deeply or accurately was his family, my community, the commitment I had already made with 3 others to birth the box, remembering the gift. This project was a dream we had been carrying to offer to others the best of the teachings we had received over so many years. We had already spent 2 of the 7 years it would take making a prototype, collecting the pathways essential in a passage through the Book of Sorrow, Grace, and Reconciliation. We were just headed out on the road, calling together groups of people to help us with its creation, its design, and its funding. We were already pregnant. Our team said the right words of congratulations when they heard my news, smiled through the fear of losing a lot, if not all of me and us, as John was CEO of our company. They knew what a baby would need and deserve, and that the 24/7 I had already been giving to the box would need to change. I could not miss their discomfort and concern. Then, when John's son cried on hearing our news, the fear we suspected of being the number one son of divorced parents, a cloud of sorts descended. At least for me, the well-wishers were not the community welcome and favorable conditions I felt any and every child and parent needs, if not deserves. At least I knew I needed it. After 3 months, I actually was not surprised I had a miscarriage. As it was coming on, John, quote, had to leave to lead a workshop in Canada. The others on our team were in their separate homes working, as we all seemed to be going through our own books of sorrow. We were living it out in our different ways while creating that book for others. Moments after I buried the fetus in our yard, my first godson drove in the driveway. I had been accompanied through the painful hours by Lizzie, our half-mutt, half-coyote, a true midwife. And now, Josh showed up unexpectedly. The one I had met when he was 12 on his first initiation journey, riding a motorbike with his dad through Colorado wild places. Now, in another bold move of initiation, he had spontaneously walked out of his second year at college, saying it was not the education he was seeking. And though I had not spoken to him in over a year, he drove west, just as I had done in my 20s, seeking something different than what he had known, even what he had been privileged to receive from a loving family. Though perhaps unnameable, what was calling him? He knew, he just knew he had to go. Fortunately, I was the driveway he first turned into. Fortunate for me, I knew I would never be childless on this planet. There were far more to be with, to raise, to support, to grow with, to learn from, and love than the one I now had to release back to the wild. There is no way to sum it all up, especially as love of men is far from over. I fell in love with the kayaker, and maybe more importantly, I learned how to paddle the river. I spent 4 years with a transatlantic sailor to discover years later I had to learn to skipper my own boat. I loved a man who did not speak English and learned to love with and be love without words. And then I met a man who at the time was in recovery from a suicide attempt, his escape from the world he was raised to excel in. When we met, I experienced his deep desire to listen to woman, to the feminine, to explore what was needed to be healed in himself and perhaps in us all. After we separated, after 7 years of riding emotional waves anchored within the force of nature, he attempted suicide again. It was within days of my mother's death. Even though by then he was with another woman, he showed up. He wanted to be of support, even at a time he was himself losing ground. I could only take a walk with him for a few hours, hoping to offer him some strength and guidance he needed. And then I returned to pass the remaining hours with my mom, finishing the painting I had begun 11 days earlier, 5 minutes before she took her last breath. We were together, as I had learned to be, beyond words. In the week following my mother's death, I showed up in Houston, Texas, to chair the International Committee for the First National Women's Conference. What an oxymoron on some level, And what a place to witness the disconnection with women of color, women of culture, by the majority of women, it seemed, from the West. A lot of what happened was so needed, so right, so courageous, so beyond timely, and a lot was missing. I could not help but feel our bigger belonging to the mother, to the earth, was somehow absent as our common ground. The style of speech, the differences leading to separation rather than respect in so many cases, was disheartening on the deepest level of the word's definition. I lost heart. I lost my faith that we could find a way, some ways, the women, to do it any better. I returned to Colorado not knowing where to turn and how to begin again. I landed in the Denver airport to get the phone message that my ex had tried again to take his life. So there it was, death again on my doorstep, another threshold I felt unprepared to cross. I went to the condo we had shared for 5 years when I was free from grad school in Denver. I cleaned up. I put away. I made as much order as I could with the extreme stress inside and out. I still do that today when feeling crazed. This was to become a pattern of mine, or perhaps a best practice, to make as much beauty and order whenever I felt there was only chaos and confusion, if not insanity. This story I have told before, I will likely tell it again. But what's important here to say is that love through it all somehow prevailed. 30 years later, I went to say goodbye to Brent, who had been suffering and living with Lou Gehrig's disease. He had lost his ability to talk, but every day he was bicycling for miles for his life, the life he had tried twice to take. We reconnected again, one last time through the silence, and I easily fell in connection, if not love, with his beautiful wife and daughters. That afternoon, the afternoon after arriving in Colorado's idyllic mountain paradise town, the afternoon after losing my mom, my faith in the women's movement, my faith in the nature of healing, my faith in nature healing Brent, I remember wandering around the streets like a ghost, wandering the streets speechless in kind of shock, I can only say now in hindsight. I bumped into Tom, a lover of someone I knew from years skiing that mountain. He had heard a bit of the story, just enough, to take me on skis to the back of the mountain where he lived. No roads in or out. A small cabin. He left me there each morning to work on the mountain, returning each night to offer a meal. Somehow, in that time, he knew how to love me. He knew that without words, through that primal love in nature, I would come to find some words again and gradually find my way home. Tom would come and go from my life, as he still does today, with a card here and there. Not a lot said, but just enough. A love we never expressed sexually, yet a significant other in my life for sure. Years later, I was told I needed surgery to address a tumor in my knee. Our doctors were so overbearing in those directions. Fortunately, Tom greeted me unexpectedly at my Colorado home and offered an alternative. He stayed and taught me everything he knew about macrobiotics over the next month, and that was a lot. 30 ginger compresses later, and a complete change of diet, the large swelling was gone. And so was a lot of my fear of illness. Sometimes I would kindly refer to Tom as husband number two. Now, I had no number one, but still, I had in my relationships discovered many of the qualities we might hope to find in one. Somehow, through my saying yes as well as no to marriage, I had found those many gifts slowly in myself. What I saw and loved in the dancer, the musician, the climber, the sailor, the poet, the healer, the radical peacemaker, the father, the priest, the courtesan, the artist, the carpenter, the farmer, even the entrepreneur restaurateur. Yes, I was a serial lover for sure, in search of wholeness, communion, connection, an opportunity to love and be loved. Is there a hierarchy of love? Was one more special than another? Was the length I stayed with one partner a measurement of greater love? Were the men I never had sexual intercourse with, who shared their children, their work in the world, their medicine, their heart, their healing, less important, loved or loving? I remember the head of one foundation I was part of, when significant others were welcomed to become members. I remember being asked by its founder, "Well, Gigi, how many significant others do you have?" "Fortunately, many," I said. Their PC effort to widen the invitation in the New Age way beyond legal spouses had not imagined a whole community might respond. For yes, community was the prayer, the response, if any, to the limitations of love, eros, sexuality, and a true essential partnership paradigm needed, I felt, in this world. I took the risk, with the many lovers I had, of appearing fickle at best, if not promiscuous, uncommitted, unstable, if not insatiable. I took the risk of being too used up or too experienced, all the time moving only with a compass of transparency and truth. Our culture, even the ones I met across culture, race, and class, did not make a lot of room for expanded love. Free love, one might say, or love free from fear, as they say at Tamara. An ownership model was embedded in most psyches, if not hearts, and the natural flow of eros, as with water, felt more continually contained, as if it was wild, wild fire. Bottom line, I have no regrets for the journey. Even the loves to which there was no requite reciprocity or return, some might say. I remember the love of destiny I felt with a significant leader and peacemaker in the Middle East, knowing and seeing that 1 + 1 would surely make 3. The chemistry, shared vision, and work was magic within our first hours of meeting. For him, however, it could only be a secret affair. He, for sure, loved his wife, his family, and room for more was limited to a secret rendezvous at best. In this, I could not partake. And somehow the no to an affair felt like some sacrifice was made within a larger story. I felt this as well when saying no to consummating a lifelong love with Peter Shenstone, legend of the Golden Dolphin, It was clear the hurt would be such for his partner, so much so that I simply could not make love with that knowing. The greater expression of love in those years was to meet the partner, offer a different kind of partnership to him, to her, and to their children. Was it as satisfying or fulfilling as the physical expression clearly might have been? On some level, of course, I'll never know. And yet I do feel we have been able to fulfill another kind of destiny. My time with Peter confirmed the import of giving attention to the love, not only the person. And so much more has come through that. There were others I said no to on the physical plane while saying yes to through every other cell in my body, heart, and mind. There were those I said yes to who chose another to sleep with and to be with, yet somehow still were able to receive the gift I offered. And there were those, too, that offered more than I could receive at the time, though far and few in between. And not to forget, the one who was a celebrity, a star, singing the love song in such a way as to open my heart, along with the millions of others. I worked on the team to bring John Denver to the USSR to play to Russians for the first time since communist rule closed concert doors. We walked the cemetery of Leningrad together. His song from that day and that journey into a place and time where no one knew him served as a kind of rite of passage. After 6 weeks, when I dared to speak up as the only woman on the team and ask how the drinking and collection of whores off the street contributed to our mission of love, he stood up. He witnessed how hard it was for me to speak, and he thanked me for the wake-up call. Though we shared that truth, that moment, there were not to be more. I was not the star that Hollywood stars are attracted to. Though that gateway was not to be open, somehow, I still longed to touch and connect through the dolphin story, through the vision we shared of more love in this world. As my then partner and leader of the trip, Jim Hickman, would say, we were willing to carry the bags of one who could reach so many. We were there at his marriage, listening to him through his separation and singing his song at his memorial. It was Jim's 50th birthday, all to be celebrated at the fanciest of hotels in San Francisco, the evening that John died. I talked to John hours before as he called to apologize for not coming to the party. It was a last-minute thing, he said. He just had to go to Monterey to try out this new plane. Like Icarus, flying towards the sun, he never came back. And I, along with so many, still feel the loss in my heart today. A feeling that there was more to do and be and realize together now would only come to fruition through the dream time. And so we meet there, and I'm grateful for that. Now, there is a definition of privilege. What a privilege it truly is to love and to be loved. Privilege, as it appears in the dictionary, says advantage, authority, benefit, exemption, freedom, license, prerogative, right. Maybe it is best to say gift. What a gift it is that gives such freedom, such benefit to any and all.